All right. What was the joke you just said?
Apparently American Idol has shows on all through Europe and France and Germany and Holland. So, and they have the same format, you know, the one pissy judge and then the other two equalizers or whatever. So, but this has actually created a little cottage industry for pissy fags all across Europe. I'm working again.
Entertainment Weekly, rejoice. What was, you think, the very first joke you ever thought of in your life?
Very first joke I ever thought of. I'm sure it was something between ages 8 and 10, having to do with a bowel movement. Probably a poop joke or a fart joke. Or, I don't know, maybe actual
first joke I ever. Okay, well, let's not linger too long there. The biggest stoner response. I was taken back to the terrible apartment in Washington Heights. I've known Lou Angelwolf for years. And you're from like a car family. Your dad had car lots, and you're all from New Jersey. Was your dad a funny guy? Everybody in your family funny?
My dad was a very funny guy, and he's actually the reason I do stand up today. Because he would come home from the car lot, and tell me jokes that he had heard at work. You know, some of them inappropriate, but you know, he was cool. And if your dad said a bad word in a joke, it just made it all the better. But we always laughed a lot in our house. And then when I got a little older, I had an interest in being a DJ, being on the radio. In fact, you know, my early, like, junior high years, that's what I wanted to be. And then I got a little older, and I really enjoyed reading out loud. So that was, I would always volunteer to read. And we need someone to read, you know, I just signed right up for that. And I used to, when I was a kid, I was a very young car salesman. And I found at an early age that if you could make people laugh, it made them more comfortable around you. And I actually would write jokes down on the back of a business card and keep them in my wallet. And as I was working the lot during the day or whatever, I would, you know, I'd share jokes with my customers and make them laugh. And later actually discussed that they usually bought cars if I made them laugh 3 times or more. That's what I was always shooting for.
Now, you're from a car family, and you're from Clearwater or Dunedin? It's Dunedin. You're from Dunedin. Charming little place next to Clearwater. Mm-hmm. And you're from a jovial, happy, joke-telling, car-selling family. You're all the things about cars I learned from you. Like, you know, you're into drag racing, and, you know, you, my dad could do it too. You point out a car. What car is that? And he would go, you know, 58, whatever.
Right.
Chevy. Sure. And you're that guy too. You can, you've always been able to nail whatever car. You can tell exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. And I met you in the 80s. When I started doing stand-up comedy, I started coming down. There's this monster comedy club, Ron Bennington's...
comedy scene.
Hilarities? Ron Bennington's comedy scene.
Comedy scene. That was, they opened in like 85, 86.
And that's when I met you. It was like 85, 80, I think 86. I had just gotten out of high school. And what do you remember about that period, that wonderful club where we all bonded and made friends? And... what do you remember about meeting me?
Ron Bennington's comedy scene was a comedy club that was designed by a comedian, a guy named G. David Howard. And G had this center stage effect in the room. And the room was totally made for stand-up to be viewed. There wasn't a bad seat in the house. It was intimate, and that room used to rock. Well, I was the house MC there. And I would hear time after time, I had long hair at the time, I was lifting weights, I was, you know, 6'3", 225 pounds. I was, you know, leather jacket with 50 pins in the left shoulder. And, you know, I was digging. I was wearing bandanas and workout Zumbas. And, you know, it was crazy. I was a fat Van Halen. Anyway, so I hear all every once in a while, I hear, Tom Rhodes did. And I would hear this name, like, echoing, you know. Well, finally, one day, I knew Harry Mielke, and you knew Harry Mielke. And he said, Tom Rhodes is coming into town tonight. He's going to do a guest set at the Comedy Scene. And that was the night I met you. Somebody else told us that we should be friends. I can't remember who all those people were back then. Maybe Mark Holland.
Well, I should just interject because it'll never be spoken otherwise. Harry Mielke, when I started being a stand-up comedian, was the king of Orlando. He was like the funniest guy in Orlando.
Yeah.
And he was on the local commercials in Orlando for the Water Bedroom Ranch.
Right, right.
And they sold water beds. And he dressed up like a cowboy, and he goes, if you're in the market for a water bed, don't get soaked. And then a big bucket of water would come splashing his face.
Oh, that's great.
And the guy was like a local celebrity, man. He was like the king of the world.
Artie Grendel.
So, yeah. I mean, Harry Mielke was my Elvis Presley when I started, man.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And those were beautiful times. We made friends instantly. You turned me on to Tom Waits, for God's sakes.
Yes.
I'm forever grateful. I remember driving, you know, countless times between, you know, Tampa and Orlando and Clearwater and Orlando. And that I-4 was so tedious. They were redoing Lakeland forever.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember Nighthawks at the Diner just absolutely blew my mind on we were driving back to Orlando or the other way. And
yeah. Listen on the stereo.
That was the first time I ever heard Tom Waits.
That was a cassette. We were listening to music on cassettes back then. And and I'll go on record while we're reminiscing and the memory's still here. John McDonald from L.A., who was from Chicago at the time when I met him, I stayed at the Comedy Condo at the club prior to the Comedy Scene, which was a club called Kisses. Kisses was in a converted Lum's hot dog stand in Countryside Mall, okay? And it was a food and beverage place for the mall during the week. And then on the weekends, they did comedy there. And Brian Regan got his start there. Jay Leno played there. John Manfrolatti. Tons and tons of comics from that made it.
But apparently, one of the things I was doing well, a big part of a relationship is it's called sleep etiquette. And if the people aren't together with that, that can cause a lot of hard times. Like, apparently, in my sleep etiquette is this. I'm a big guy. I like to sleep on the right side of the bed, on my left side, with two pillows bunched up just like this. I usually have one arm hanging off the side of the bed. My old girlfriend, she used to like to sleep in other guys' beds with her legs in the air. We were incompatible.
Talk about comedy in Florida in the 80s. It was massive here.
There was comics everywhere. There were comedy clubs everywhere. It was just a delightful time. Everything was fun. Everybody was partying. Everybody was making enough money. We were traveling across the country, seeing everything, and kind of like little Kmart rock stars, you know? We'd show up and yuck it up for a week and move on to the next town. It was hard to beat.
A lot of great comedians came out of Florida in the 80s, man. Brian Regan, and the thing I always say about Regan, even tough one-nighters in Daytona at biker bars, he always was clean.
Yeah.
He was always Brian. He never, you know, he didn't like, okay, I'm going to do it. he didn't have a, you know, mysterious dick joke, you know, five minute hunk that he would pull out on right. tough situations. He really, you know,
he towed the line all the time,
always did it. And then, my God, there was so many comedy clubs here and it was so great. And there's just Florida and Sunshine. And then, Ron and Ron sure. were massive. And those were really fun times. Ron and Ron were on the radio, like all over the state. And I think all the way up, halfway up the East Coast at one point. And we were regulars on that show. And Ron had his club. And Ron was my, Ron Bennington was really my true Elvis. When I saw Ron Bennington, I completely forgot about Harry Mielke. Ron Bennington was the first comedian I ever saw throwing thunderbolts.
Right.
And just lightning, like Moses or some shit. And he was the first comedian I ever saw actually talking about things that mattered.
Yeah.
Everybody else was doing this really fluffball cream pie bullshit in Florida in the 80s. And it was hugely influential. And what about those times with Bennington and the radio show? What were some of your best memories from all of that juggernaut?
I do have to give Ron Bennington like eternal credit. He's actually the guy I got my joke writing spirit from.
He's where I learned how to write jokes and talk about things as well.
Yeah, his level of comparative humor just struck a chord with mine. And, I'm definitely from his school without him even teaching me. He was just such an infectious guy, and I loved his style. Yet I could kind of write like him without exactly sounding like him, which was a blessing because it helped me find my own niche. But and Bennington gave me a handful of bits when he stopped doing stand-up, and a couple of them I still do almost every night, you know. And I just, you know, I'm a true fan of his. And his thing with the radio show, I mean, he was the Howard Stern of Florida. You know, he and Diaz had the best show. It was a real rock star energy, and it was a lot of fun. And we had a lot of laughs. We made some money, you know, good memories, you know.
I find it hard to remember street jokes. You have always known the funniest street jokes ever. The one about you told a couple the other night about, at my age, I'd rather have a talking frog.
Right.
And then the other one was the ice melted, and it's a dude. Can you do those jokes?
Sure. Exactly.
Take the mic.
Okay. You know, people up north brag about how cold it gets, just like people from Florida brag about how warm it is. You hear them up there all the time. I'm talking to this guy from Michigan. He said, it gets so cold in Michigan in the wintertime, when you talk, you have to wait for the words to defrost before you can even hear them. I said, man, that's cold. This guy said, well, I live over in Wisconsin. It gets so cold in Wisconsin. Last year, I was walking down the sidewalk. I spit, killed a poodle. I said, man, that's pretty cold. Because I live up in Minnesota. It gets so cold in Minnesota. Last year I was sleeping, I felt something in my pajamas. I reached around back there, I pulled out a big old chunk of ice, and I held it up to the lantern, and it melted, and it melted, and it melted, and went. yeah, that's a champ. Can't not tell that joke.
What is the, what's the frog joke?
Okay. 80-year-old guy's out golfing, hits one off in the rough. As he's looking for his ball, there's a frog sitting next to it. He goes, hey, buddy, I'm really not a frog. I'm actually a beautiful princess. And if you pick me up and give me a kiss, I'll turn into a beautiful princess, and I'll satisfy your every sexual desire. So the old guy picks up the frog, puts him in his golf bag, finishes up his round, goes to the clubhouse, takes a shower. He's sitting there at the 19th hole having a cocktail with his friend. And his friend's very excited. He goes, well, did you do it, man? Did you kiss the frog? Did it turn into a beautiful princess? What happened? And the old guy says, at my age, I'd rather have a talking frog.
And it's so hilarious. Like,
uh. I love you, Lou Angel Wolf, and I've known you forever. We can talk about whatever you want. I mean, you know me better than anyone. You're my best friend.
Yep.
And there was the time you came and saved me when we lived in New York. I lived in New York City. Mm-hmm. The worst year of my life. This girl that I had moved there with, I found out she was screwing a rich kid from Connecticut. I read it in her diary.
Right.
And I had this year lease on this shithole of an apartment in Washington Heights.
Right.
Which is above Harlem, for fuck's sake. I always liked that song.
It's the Bronx.
I always liked that song, Taking the A Train, that old jazz number.
Yeah.
Fuck that. The A Train takes forever to get from Washington Heights to the center of Manhattan. And I had this, I was up there and you moved up there with me, and I was I was the skinniest I had ever been, man. I was surviving off roast pork, fried rice for like $1.50 at the little neighborhood Chinese place. I wasn't getting sets, and I was doing like, you know, one nighters in New Jersey and Long Island. And you had family in New Jersey, and they gave us lots of meals and things. So what about that disaster? And I'll never forget how great it was. One day we just looked at each other and said, fuck this. And we loaded up, you know, our two futons and drove back to Florida.
I had a station wagon.
Wow. We loaded up.
Yep.
I'll never forget. The landlord guy was saw us moving shit. And he's looking at us and I go, we're getting new ones.
Yeah. And we were acting like, yeah, like we were recycling this stuff or something. And we loaded up the truck. I had a station wagon. And we borrowed a trailer from somebody and drug all that stuff back to Florida. We got on the other side of the Washington State Bridge over on the Washington, the George Washington Bridge. We got on the Jersey side. We stopped and we stood on like the roof of the car and flipped it off. New York at the time, I mean, it was cool. I did have some great times there. That's where we hung out with Spanky all the time. And I really did like living in New York. But it was just, we were leaving New York to go to Tennessee and North and just driving back to New York for a couple of days and then sleeping. It just didn't make sense for us to be all the way up there because all our work was in the Southeast, or most of it. But you started going further and further out west, and you wound up, let's see, that was what, 90, 91. And I moved to L.A. later that year. Yeah, that's when I went to L.A. in 90.
Oh my God. Yeah. And then I helped you move to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You had a, well, that was a great time. I went back to Florida and I lived in this party house on the lake. I learned how to water ski. I was so happy not to be in New York and, you know, the winter.
Yeah. We both rented a room from, your friend.
My friend Janine.
Janine.
She lived in a great little house on the on Little Lake Fairbanks on Fairbanks Avenue in Winter Park.
Yeah.
Great little dock that we had on the lake, and all just swimming and water skiing. It was fantastic. It was great to be amphibious Florida boy compared to New York turd slumped over in the rain. But then later than that next year, I helped you move to Los Angeles. You had fallen in love with some buxom woman that was from L.A. You went Allison in Hollywood. And I remember we packed your truck in the rain and did the most dangerous maneuver ever. We put a automobile inside of a large truck on cinder blocks on wooden planks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, imagine driving to Los Angeles from Florida. I mean, you're going to hit a bump or two.
Yeah.
We had Lou's furniture and clothes all like piled up and on top of and around this car. Because we had to, we were pulling on a trailer another car.
Yeah.
So we.
Let me tell you about that car.
And oh my Lord, we packed in the rain. And do you remember that journey across America?
I totally remember that journey across America. We were bringing my 1964 Dodge Polara 500 convertible, which had a 440 cubic inch big block Mopar in it. 375 horse, had a Holley 750 on it, dual exhaust. That car flew. We had that on a trailer, and we had my 79 Malibu wagon loaded. Malibu. The Malibu wagon was loaded with stuff inside the 24-foot budget rent-a-truck. And then we had all kinds of stuff top of that. And that's when we were going across Texas, and we had mentioned to each other, hey, isn't there an inspection coming up? Isn't there a border crossing or something coming up? And we went, yeah. So we drove past it. We'd been driving since Florida. I think we stopped one night in, as soon as we got into Texas. And this is the end of the other day, the next day.
Can I, because the scenario was, you had done the drive once before. And you said, all we got to worry about is, well, you just got to get past El Paso.
Right.
And you said there's a check after before El Paso or after whatever. So we get past El Paso and we smoke to celebrate. We smoke all these, you know, smoke a joint and we're totally high. Lou was right. The checkpoint was before El Paso if you're going from LA to Florida, but from Florida to LA, it's after El Paso. So we pull up, we come in, and we got this big illegal load. We're both so high, we look Asian. We look like a couple of Asian guys. We look like a couple of Asian guys pulling up. And we're rolling down the window because we're driving. All of a sudden, it just becomes bright lights everywhere, and we roll down the windows, and we're trying to air it out. And I remember the dog.
We passed this thing that was like a vegetable check station, and we thought that was it. We went, oh, the border thing's closed. So we were celebrating. We thought we had made it. Oh, it's closed.
Burn one, man.
Yeah, exactly. So we spark up, and we actually had, no, you know what? Yeah, okay. We actually had something in the car in a, like a Seven Seas salad dressing bottle.
No, we had a little satchel of weed. You put it in You put it in your briefcase. You had a very nice black leather attaché case.
Uh-huh.
And nice. We nice. Roll it up. We put it in the thingy in his briefcase under the driver's seat. And you know, it's a big U-Haul truck with a, you know, single seat across the thing. They see we're high. They pull us over. They bring a drug dog
nice.
to come and smell everything. And the dog jumped up into the cab.
I remember this.
The dog jumped up into the cab, and then the dog actually like stood up on its hind legs on the seat and went, "The dope's underneath the driver's seat."
Yeah, and we were just caught red-handed, you know. And the guy asked us, "Do you have any more?" And we went, "No, we don't have any more." And so he said, "Look," he said, "I got about 2 hours worth of paperwork. If we do this," he goes, "take it out there in the field and dump it out." So we took it. I took it about 50 yards away. Turned around. Okay, yeah. So I shake it out in the wind, right? He goes, "And bring me back the empty bag." So I bring him back the empty bag, and cool. And he let us pack up and go.
Wow.
And we got about a quarter of a mile away from this place, and I said to Tom, I said, "Well, I'm tired, my heart's pounding, and we're out of weed."
Yeah, the guy was, they said they were looking mostly for like illegals. The guy didn't want the paperwork for a little minuscule amount of.
They built a wall at the border between the United States and Mexico. That really angers me, man. These are the people who gave us the margarita. Why would we separate ourselves from such magic people? I don't know if you read in the newspaper, but Mexico is considering legalizing all forms of drugs. If they do that, they'll have to build a wall to keep me out. Mexico, por favor, it's your amigo Tomas, please. I I can do yard work. I can clean. I'll stand in front of El Casa Depot all day.
But then I remember we pushed it and we drove. We stopped in Joshua Tree and drove your Mr. Drysdale car around. Yeah. And that was like my first photo shoot. You took pictures of me in the desert in Joshua Tree.
And that was your...
My wild dog press kit.
Wild dog promotions, absolutely. Yeah, I took some black and white pictures of Tom in my convertible in the Joshua Tree forest. And it really came out nice.
Yeah, they were gorgeous. And then we got all the way to Hollywood, and sometimes I'll pass that place on Franklin because there's a dip there and you have to slow down when you're barreling through Hollywood. That apartment house, I'll never forget, we got there and like we're exhausted, and Allison was like, okay, I want the lamp over here and I want this over here. Like we had to like...
Right.
Your chick wants us to move all the shit immediately.
Yeah, we were like bushed. We'd been driving for 3.5 days. I thought maybe we'd go in, take a little nap, maybe shower, you know, then start unloading. But man, as soon as we landed, she started barking out orders.
But you really, you were enjoying Hollywood there for a while, man. You were, you know, slicing and dicing. And what were your best memories about living in Hollywood and worst?
I loved living in Hollywood because it was...
you turned me on to Concrete Blonde.
Concrete Blonde. Allison was kind of like in the hip underground part of it. She was a bartender at one of the coolest bars in town. And she was a real rocker. She was a good chick. And when I was in love with her, she was great. But man, when it was over, oh, dude, it was like carrying around wet cement blocks. It was no fun.
We've both seen each other through. We both lifted each other up when we were heartbroken over various women and stuff. What sage advice can you tell us about the feminine mystique?
Man, they're all beautiful. They really are. I mean, all women are beautiful. They have an inner beauty that men don't have. But consequently, they're also the most mysterious things on earth. They're pretty unpredictable. Some of them need more things than others. But you know, they're what makes the whole world go round. It's the man and woman thing. You know, it's eternal. It's forever. And they'll always, you know, I love women. I love the one I got right now.
Mm-hmm. She's a good one. You have made me chuckle and guffaw and snort many times. A lot of great little sayings like, stick with me, kid. I'll have you farting through silk. I have heard that in movies since then. You were the first guy I ever heard say that. How about some other...
Luferisms? A lot of it came with cars. There's a lot of car looperisms. Like if a car's really low on gas, it's on walk. That car's on walk. Or if it's lower than that, it's on push. Let's see. Of course you ask for them. I don't have them fucking, you know, served up here.
That's okay. Tell me anything, Lou. Whatever you want to talk about.
Okay.
You drive for a while. You ask the questions.
All right, Tom. I have been your best friend for 24 years, 23 years. We met, what, in 87?
86.
86, 87, yeah. And I'm always awed by your ability to wander and travel. I mean, you're the best. You're the best I know at it. I mean, you really took that dream of seeing the world and went and saw it on your own steam, man, on your own volition, your own power. And your success cannot be measured strictly monetarily. I mean, you have a wealth of experience, and you've had a wealth of love and passion in your life, and you've had your share of shit and pain. You know, I mean, you're an amazing human being, and always dig the time we get to spend together. I mean, you know, we've been there at the best times, we've been there at the worst times, and it's just amazing. I loved working with you the other week. We did a show in Sarasota back in, March of 2010?
Yeah, and let me just say that in all the time that I've known you, you know, you never really kind of broke out of Florida. As I've traveled the world and we've been best friends forever, I couldn't wait to leave Florida. Now I've had an epiphany in the last, like, 10 years when I come back. I'm like, oh, my God, it's paradise. What was I so angry about? Right. But I was, you know, I wanted to see the world and all that. And you stayed here. And I have to say, man, you know, there's been times I've seen you where, like, you seemed like, oh, okay, Florida regional, funny. Right. But this time I saw you, you were at the funniest I had ever seen you. And not regional at all, just hysterically, wildly, wonderfully funny. And you put fire under my ass. It was beautiful.
Nice. I just recently, and from meeting Beverly, Beverly ignited a different spirit in me. I really want to go show off for her for some particular reason. I've known her since high school, and I really love it when she's in the audience, and it's fun. And she makes it, and she made a lot of my life more fun. You know, my life is a lot more physical. I'm a lot more passionate. I'm a lot more romantic than I've ever been. And it's the good side of life. It really is. And I kind of let that passion bleed through. I kind of took off my, you know, I was always involved in a church or something like that. It was kind of like a governing sanction over me. Like I kind of had to be accountable to everybody there. So I couldn't, you know, my material had to be very safe. I couldn't, you know, let it rip. But the funnier stuff sometimes is a little dirtier. And, you know, full use of language is better than a edited use of language. So it's, I have some artistic ways of expressing myself. And now with this new energy that I got and this, I'm making it more conversational. And I'm just connecting more and more with my audiences. It really, really feels good because it's just time for me. I'm at the top of my game. I got a lot to offer the world in one sense. And I totally think it's, you know, I got in this game a long time ago because the stars are the limit. You know, this is showbiz, man. Anything can happen. You can go on the wildest ride of your life. And I've been playing it pretty safe for a lot of years, but now my son's in a good place. You know, he's got a cool life, so I don't have to worry much about him. And I got a good life. I got everything that I need except success, financial success, if that's what you want to call it. But I got, I'm spiritually, I feel great. I'm ready to work as hard as I got to work. I just could use some Gitas. You know, I could use a little Do Re Mi. So, because, you know, when you gotta always concern yourself with that, it detracts from your artistic point of view.
Funny, I remember you used to say, "I'm tapioca'd." You were broke. You weren't broke. You were, "I'm tapioca'd." And then when you wanted to say no for something, you'd go, "I'm gonna Pasadena." There's a lot of great Louism.
So would you travel now more?
I think I'm going to start taking more stuff, you know.
Well, you know, you seem a lot, you definitely are a lot more happy and alive now. And, pardon me.
Wow.
Wow.
Holy crap. What's that? You going to need that?
some buildings just crumbled in Japan. You seem happier than you've been in years, and you seem alive. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about that period of your life. You know, you were married, and you said you were involved in the church, but you were like a preacher in a biker Christian biker gang. They met at a bar. I went a few times. Yeah. Tell me about your being a preacher in a Christian biker gang.
Okay. Well, it was actually called a motorcycle ministry. What it was. It was called the Salvation Saloon, and they were just a really nice bunch of Christian people. They were the least judgmental believers I've met. And we got together every Sunday morning. We had conventional church service. We were kind of we had a slight attachment to the Baptist church, and we'd meet every Sunday. We played rock and roll music. I did comedy every Sunday morning. I did the Saloony Report, and would just tell, you know, do news of the weird and tell some jokes or experience or try out material. I mean, they were great. They were a great audience, and I used to really share my heart there. And it was a good thing for the time that it was. It ran its season in my life. I started kind of expanding my mental horizons. I love Jesus. His name will probably be the last thing on my lips. But I believe that that there's even more to the world than that. I mean, there's, you know, there just can't be that one thing. And that's the one thing that Christianity kind of pleads, is it's the only game in town.
Yeah.
It's either this or you're wrong. And I really don't think the creator of the universe that made, you know, hundreds of thousands of kinds of fish, you know, 12 different kinds of clouds, and billions of people with billions and billions of hearts and billions of souls would have set such a narrow gate. I do believe that we're all a lot more taken care of than American Christianity would lead you to believe. I'm not going to deny it. You know, I mean, I still believe, like I did, you know, 27 years ago, but it's a lot bigger now, and I'm a lot less judgmental on people. I don't look at things the way I used to a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you got a little Christian wacky there for a while, and you know, you certainly your spiritual scope is larger,
mm-hmm.
and. It's a beautiful thing, and I really enjoyed the Christian biker church,
mm-hmm.
and I went, you know, half a dozen times. And what I would always tell people at the Christian biker church, you'd always see a lot of guys with their devil tattoos. You know, like the 666 is all covered up now, and right. They tried to make the devil look like Goofy or Pluto. You know,
yeah.
But there were some beautiful souls there, and some beautiful people I felt, and it. And you certainly were at home, and it was a really cool thing. You had, it was like you did some wonderful funny monologues. A few times. I think I even filmed a couple of them.
Yeah.
And the thing that I couldn't understand, okay, so you know, whatever happens with people, you fell out of love with your wife or however you got with Beverly, you know, you had to get divorced, and then now you're persona non grata with the biker dudes. And I mean, surely some of them had stabbed people before.
I bear no malice towards any of them, you know. I understand, you know, within, you know, there's church and there's religion, and within the confines of the religion, what I did, by leaving one woman and going to another while you're still married, the church looks down on that. Right. So I had to play by their rules, and it didn't stop me from loving God. And a lot of people viewed it as sin, and I'm backsliding and going to hell, and I got a demon and all this other stuff. And I had my initial eruptions with that. But the reality of it is about three guys from that place called me. I still stay in touch with a couple of them. And it's just, you know, I behaved in a way. See, I was in a leadership position. So I was not being a model, you know, biker preacher. So, but it expanded my world. I still love those guys and those women. They're really great people. But it's just, it's not, I'm painting with a bigger brush these days. That's all.
Nice.
Very nice. Now, you know, you also, since I've known you, you've been a gearhead, really into cars, and I really like that. And Jesus, you've, you know, my family bought, you know, no less than half a dozen cars from your family lot, and you've helped me out in 9 million frigging automotive emergencies and things. One of the greatest tricks, you taught me Rain-X, put it on your windshield. Mm-hmm. I drove around with broken windshields for like, you know, a year. You get a bottle of Rain-X and the rain, hello, just goes right off.
You had to fix the wipers? I don't think so.
Yeah. Versus
do it with Rain-X.
Yeah. Yeah. Fix a flat, all kinds of great little tricks.
What do you mean,
I've
wipers?
Learned from you. But, you know, you also used to be a real motorcycle fanatic, and me as your best friend, you told me you'd never ride another one, and you're totally because you had this accident where you almost died,
right?
And you know, there's nothing like almost dying to make you appreciate living.
That's absolutely.
And so I mean, how do you feel about motorcycles and all that now?
Well, I love motorcycles. I love to look at them. I love the machinery part of them. I mean, they're awesome. They're moving art, as technologically advanced as they are today. And I love the old basic bikes too, the antique Harleys and the Knuckles and the Panheads. They're cool bikes. And they look beautiful. They have flowing lines, and you know, they had a real, and there was form and function, and they were great. But for me to ride in Florida is really congested. I live in Pinellas County, Florida, which is one of the most congested counties in the United States. And the old people around here are not good with motorcycles. And there's always somebody buying the farm in my county on a motorcycle. Well, when I almost died back in 2001, I had broken... I went over my handlebar. I hit something in the road. Bike went out of control. I flew over the handlebars. I broke my ribs, scapula, collarbone, punctured my lung, ruptured my spleen and my kidney. And what was happening was is my lungs were filling up with liquid in the middle of the night. Thank God somebody came in to check me. I would have drowned in my own body fluids in a matter of time, because I was like passing out because I was on a morphine drip because I was all banged up. Well, after I got out of there and realized I'd been spared, I said, well, I had a son at the time. You know, my son wasn't very old. He was 2 at the time. And I didn't want to miss him growing up. I've seen enough trees, man. I did enough motorcycling. I've ridden well over 100,000 miles in my life, and I've had a whole bunch of bikes, and, you know, I've really spent some good times on motorcycles. But it was just, it was time. It was time for it to move on. You know, I don't live in fear, but, you know, I see it all the time. So I got to play on the safe side there.
Yeah, and in Florida, there's no helmet laws, and you see guys with no helmet, flip-flops, and, you know, yeah, they're on that homoerotic Japanese bike with their ass in the air.
Also known, also known as a statistic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Organ donors.
I told you, when I went to Aruba, the whole island's like 3 miles long, yeah, and you see those ninja motorcycles, yeah, like, everywhere, and they'll never be able to get it up to like 60 miles an hour. There's a roundabout, there's
yeah. So, I've been there. I know what you mean.
If you don't wear your seatbelt in this state, you can get a $150 ticket for not wearing a seatbelt. I drive a great big Chevy Suburban. It's got a dual roll cage built into the frame. It's got 7 airbags around me. It sits 2.5 feet off the ground. It's got 17-inch wheels. And you're as safe as in your mother's arms driving the Chevy Suburban. But if you don't put on your 3-point harness, you are in violation of that. You don't put on the seatbelt, the airbag, the side airbag, the curtain bag, the pillow bag, the douchebag that sold it to you. None of it matters. But if you don't have your lap belt on, you're in trouble. You can get a ticket. That's the law. But you're driving through traffic in your Chevy Suburban with your seatbelt on, and pulls up next to you some guy on a motorcycle, no shirt, flip-flops, no helmet, balls flapping in the breeze. He's totally within code parameters. He's completely
What is that? I know your son Isaac is a huge source of joy, and it's beautiful the relationship you guys have. What's your favorite things about being the father of Isaac?
Isaac is a kid that any parent would just wake themselves up and pinch themselves if that was this really my kid. He's a kind-hearted boy. He's got a wonderful sense of humor. He's very athletic. He's really fit. I mean, he's one of the top tennis players in the state in his age group. He's fantastic. He gets good grades. He listens to his mom and dad. He's got a good stepdad who loves him a lot. His mom, you know, is a total worrywart and, you know, drives me crazy. But she takes really good care of Isaac and, you know, he's well loved. He's well protected. She works her ass off to get him things. Like he's gonna go to private school and he takes these tennis lessons. Nice. And, I mean, it's she really does work hard on his behalf. And I what can I say but thank you? You know, I mean, that's awesome. And but he's just so much fun, and he's so much my kid.
Tell me some funny stories.
Well, just last night we had dinner with my old friend, my old roommate, Jeff Thorne, who was my roommate when we met. Jeff's doing real well. His family, he's had a crazy seesaw life with partying and not partying. But he's got his wife and his two kids now, and everything's together. And knucklehead Jeff has pulled it together. And we all went to Sweet Tomatoes last night and had a big salad dinner. And Isaac's sitting there, like, literally, like, pontificating about tennis. He's like, yeah, Jeff, I really like it. You know, he says the athleticism, the technical part of it. You know, it's a very, very interesting game. This is my 10-year-old son talking to my 50-year-old friend.
Wow.
You know, and he's just awesome. I mean, you know, I only had to spank him, like, twice in his whole life. And that's nice. Now it's like a... It's just a reference point. I just go, how long has it been since you had a spanking? And he goes, oh, okay. He knows he's out of bounds, you know. So, but he's handsome. I just
love
looking
really
at him.
He's really handsome, yeah.
I just love looking at him, you know. And I just, you know, I get him like a day and a half, a week. You know, I get him on Sundays and sometimes a little bit during the week. I go by his school and have lunch with him once a week, which is really nice.
Nice.
So, yeah, he's an awesome kid. So, I couldn't be happier. And, you know, I would kind of wish, you know, part of my dream was to be in the same house watching him grow up every day. But that's not the reality. The universe moved, and here I am. And it's the best case scenario for him. If I'm not there, it's the next best thing. So, a lot of times in life, you got to take the next best thing. Not necessarily the best thing isn't for you. Or what you would, or what you thought it was. You may have just thought it.
Now, you've given me some of the best advice in my life. And then also some, you know, well, I'll let you judge for yourself. There's been times where there's been times where like I was having some big problem or whatever. Well, it's actually quite loving what you would say. You'd always say, "Hey, kid, you need to take a walk through a burn unit. You don't have any problems. You think you got problems, kid? You need to take a walk through a burn unit." Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it does put it into perspective.
Yeah,
well, it's like,
well, I think a good friend has to shut up a whiny ass friend. Yeah, and believe me, it was like a big brother move. You know, it's like, yeah, I think I did it with my arm around your shoulder. You know what I mean? But I get the same way, man. I get to whine, and you know, the reality of it is, my life is fantastic. I'm happy, I'm healthy, I'm loved, you know, I'm moving forward. I don't have everything I want, but isn't that life? Moving forward, you know? I got great friends. I got a beautiful chick. I got a beautiful son. I had a hip replacement done a couple of years ago. I can move. I can screw. I can do all kinds of great stuff I formerly couldn't
do. You can do the swivel hip now.
Oh, dude, I'm pretty... pretty happy about all that.
Now, I thought we were in Kissimmee, but we're actually in St. Cloud, and we're at some friends of yours' house out in the woods. They got a stage made out of, what is it, an old...
It's a semi-trailer.
It's an old semi-trailer, and we're by a fire. They got a recording studio, and I've been your best friend for, what, 25 years? And how come you never introduced me to these Florida hippies?
Well, Pat,
I could have done a lot of good work out here.
Well, I just came out here just a few weeks ago for the first time.
Oh,
here. But Pat Shank, who's been my buddy for a long time, we worked together when we worked with Vinny, and he's one of those guys that's always made me laugh every time. I mean,
and I got rid of the body.
He said you were his camp counselor, Camp Counselor Lou.
No, that's
a joke.
He lives in a little universe all by himself. No, he was just going for like a low, you know, just the lowest common denominator kind of joke.
Got it.
Which he's a specialty. Yeah. Which he specializes in. No, but anyway, Pat's just—he's always funny. He can always make me laugh, and he's also the guy that I really like to do my Stevie Sussman impression for. Because it just makes him laugh easily, I believe.
I fucking love it.
So and I'll just out of the blue, like if I need a laugh, I'll call Pat and I'll start doing some Stevie stuff. I'll ask him stuff. I'll say, say Patrick. Like say you were live next door to this biker, right? And he was sentenced to jail. He's gonna do 3 years in jail for selling crystal meth. Okay. But you knew in his garage, his Harley was in there. You knew where the key was. While he was in jail, would you ride his bike?
Stevie Sussman.
So I just will call up Patrick in the middle of the day. I'll say, "Hey, Patrick," and I'll reveal something to him.
Wisdom.
I'll impart a little wisdom to him sometimes. I say, "Patrick, you know, Scott Tissue is the best value that you can get on the market, please. But they can't even tell you the best thing about it. It's no dingleberries. That's the best part. You know, they don't leave any little shit wicks hanging off your ass."
That shit is funny, man.
And Stevie Sussman is—it's so weird. I almost like channel this guy because I get his cadence down, and you know he has a timing of his own, and I really love doing him. And I think though, I hope this interview doesn't get really popular because I think though I'm going to keep him totally separate from Lou Angel Wolf. I don't think it's going to be Lou Angel Wolf doing anything. I'm going to launch him as a character on his own. But I totally do them differently than my own self. I don't, you know, it doesn't really, like if you look at me doing this voice, it doesn't really match, right? I hope not, right?
No comments.
Well, you need to give me the stuff you've recorded, and we need to get it out as soon as possible, because I remember you had this brilliant idea for a little turd. It was a little turd of a man, and you had it, even had it drawn up, and you were going to mass market it with T-shirts, and you had the little turd says all these different things, and then South Park did that, and you had that idea like 5 years ahead of that. If you'd had your shit together...
You know, it's true. Mr. Hankey wiped me off the map. Really, what happened?
Or you wiped it off the map.
But I had this thing. It was, he was the lovable little turd, and he was a philosopher. He was just a little pile of poop sitting on the ground, and he would
look
talk.
Look, thou art.
And he would talk, and he would make commentaries on things that he saw, you know. And he was very funny. And I started the marketing plan, and it just... And just as I was like, it was like arching up, I had contacted a toy maker. I was going to have little fluffy stuffed turds that you could buy like at Spencer's Gifts. And he had a comic strip that went with him. And there was some music. And just as that happened, South Park came out with Mr. Hankey, which was the little happy dancing turd. Hi, I'm Mr. Hankey. So it just like wah, wah, wah.
Stole your
turn.
Maybe, yeah, I stole it. You know.
Like a buzzkill.
Stole your poo.
Yep. Hey, not that, you know, talking poo is.
It's funny.
It is funny. It's. And the lovable little turd, he just had, he was kind of like Forrest Gump of dung, is really what he was.
Well, I've known you a long time, and I have confidence you'll think of a new shit joke.
Yeah, man.
One even bigger than their shit joke.
I have made a living out of
their shit joke isn't going to be shit after the world hears your
I'm
shit
writing
joke.
The big shit joke. The master shit joke. Yeah, I mean, I've written enough ass references in my life. I don't know what it is.
What joke of yours are you the most proud of that you've ever done? The one that you just, whatever.
I like a lot of my new stuff. I like my double standards bit that I come up with and actually co-written by Bobby Taylor. Bobby Taylor gave me some of those premises that are just fantastic. I like my diet bit, my big long diet piece.
Loved
my
it.
Diet my
yeah.
diet tribe, I call it. And I really love doing my show these days. And I like, you know, sparking with the audience too. I like I like working the crowd a little bit. They're pretty funny sometimes.
You charm the hell out of a room, and you are very conversational. And like I said, you are the funniest I have ever seen you. You are firing on all pistons. And what is the greatest advice anyone has ever given you?
Probably. You and I just talked about this the other day. The
duck.
Jimmy Wiggins talked about doing stand-up comedy like seducing a woman. You just don't dive right in there and start, thumping away. You take your time, you tickle around, you move slowly but deliberately. And that's how you conquer. And I tell you, it's finally, Wiggins' words of wisdom has finally, gelled in my life. I've found that. And I do like inviting people in conversationally. Where I would, what happens is I'm not doing enough shows right now. See, if I was doing shows every night, which I would love to do again somehow, I don't know how, but the universe hopefully will see that to happen. I could actually work the crowd and just pick up premises out of the crowd and just spontaneously do, a rapid fire show. As far as influences go, Jimmy Schubert, I love watching Jimmy work, and his energy. I'm kind of a little bit of you. I'm a little bit of Tom Rhodes, a little bit of Ron Bennington, a little bit of Jimmy Schubert, a little bit of Brian Regan. you know, I'm this amalgamation, and yet I'm, you know, it's just fun. Fun way to finally coming into my marketable end anyway. I think it's really happening for me now.
Nice. Well, you couldn't be more lovable, and I've known you a long time. And I just want to clarify that the way Jimmy Wiggins gave me that advice, he said, don't go out there and just, you don't go out and just rip a girl's pants off and try and fuck her. Go out there and rub their clits. And I was like, that's the same advice Lou was talking about. He is one of the greatest comedy advice ever. Rub their clits.
Yeah. True story.
Yeah. So what is your favorite thing about being a comedian?
I mean, I hate to sound corny and cliche, but it's the
ah.
Yeah.
Watch the bottom, Mr. Smith.
I didn't touch it, bro.
It's okay. I think it's loose.
It's a little bit loose.
Like two monkeys fucking a football over there, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. You are hell on a USB port, my friend. My favorite thing about doing stand-up comedy is definitely the laughter. There's just hearing the laugh, hearing, having the joke land. Probably the next best or the best thing in that thing is if you launch a joke and then tag it with a fresh line to suit the situation, which, you know, it's been happening for me lately. And that's a great feeling because you really do feel like, yeah, I'm doing this. I'm steering this now. I got it. And just having a control of, you know, a couple hundred people's emotions all at once, knowing that you're actually aiding them in their life, that you're making them laugh, you're relaxing their body, you're releasing endorphins in their body, you're actually helping their health. And, you know, that's awesome. I've come to really kind of realize that. So I think my motivation has been kind of redefined. I really, really love making the people laugh. Yeah.
Do you have any words of wisdom or any advice at all that you would like to give to the people of the world?
Well, that's a big question.
I'm going to wrap it up unless you can think of anything else.
No, I'll,
whatever you want
to. Okay. I of course have something for it. Okay. I even think I went through my fucking life without answer to that. The thing that's always amazed me about humanity and all the gods and all the religions and all the societies that have come and gone on this earth, Yeshua, Jesus, he said one thing, which is actually the key to the whole universe. He said, love one another. And we have never, ever had a day in the existence of this world where we all just loved each other one day. Everybody, we've never harmoniously or universally done it. There's always war. There's always hate. There's always pain. We've never been able to pull it together as a race and as a species, you know. And I find that sad, but I also find that, you know, that's part of the catalyst or the activator in life. You know, you take the good, and you have to have more good in you than bad in you so you can just endure. You can't let the bad overtake you. You have to remain conscious that you have to fill yourself with good. You have to fill yourself with good friends, good people, good ideas, look at beautiful things, go to beautiful places, and, you know, really enjoy your time here, because that's what God wants you to do. He really wants you to enjoy your time here. Get to know him any way you can, whatever way you will, whatever. And be nice to each other. Be nice, just, you know? You don't want people kicking you in the shins? Don't kick people in the shins. you don't want your shit stolen out of your house, don't steal shit out of people's houses. You know, I mean, you want everything to be true yourself. You know, and I've not done it right myself, but I, you know, I can dream a little. That's it.
Well, I sure do love you, Lou Angel Wolf, and thanks for being my best friend for all these years, and all the sandwiches we've shared, and all the chuckles and laughter.
Yeah, we've had some big laughs, Tom. Shit, man. You're just one of those guys that, you know, make me need oxygen.
I remember that time we lived in that house on Fairbanks where we had a party and somebody had punched a hole in the wall.
Ah.
And you wrote this beautiful note that male aggression and something like that, it's acts of mindless violence like this that keep people from achieving higher planes of love and consciousness. And I always thought it was... always thought that was a really beautiful sentence.
And it's that.
A higher planes of love and consciousness. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
Amen. Amen. And I wrote that in magic marker on the door over the punch mark where the guy punched the door. And it sat there for years. Nobody ever painted over it or fixed the door. And the guy that punched the hole actually lived there later on. So... But you know what? I think it changed him, though. Remember? He started to get a little... I think he looked at that a couple of times. And,
yeah.
May have gotten it a little better towards the end.
Mm-hmm. All right, buddy.
I love you, buddy. Man.